Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be focusing on stock selections and we're going to be looking at the tools available to investors to enhance their investment process. We're going to be looking at some of the best performing stocks of 2025 and we're also going to be looking forward to 2026. And what that can hold for investors in UK stocks. And to do that, we're very kindly joined today by Edward Croft, who is the CEO and founder of Stockopedia. Edward, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
It's great to be here, Jonathan. Thanks for having me.
I think we spoke probably about a similar time last year, actually.
Yes.
Ed. And yeah, we had a really good conversation there and we've had a tremendous year for markets, particularly looking at UK stocks. So, I mean, just this morning, we're looking at a FTSE 100 above that 9,800 level. So a really good level for investors, the equity bulls there. But we're going to be looking at a couple of layers deeper than that. We're going to be looking at some of the stocks that have performed and, of course, at Stockopedia's technology for investors and how they're able to select some of the best performing stocks out there. But before we get into it, please, could you give us an introduction, first of all, to yourself as well as Stockopedia, for those that may not be aware?
Yeah, of course. I have a background originally in the city in asset management. I came out of uni. I went to Goldman Sachs and I worked in essentially private wealth and running a couple of billion of private assets. And I did that for a few years and then I ran a small fund for a few years. And essentially, I became a private investor after a period later, and I was looking around on the web and I couldn't really find the tools that I would like to invest successfully. And I didn't want to sort of fork out for a Bloomberg at, 30 grand or whatever it was, and thought, well, maybe there's a better way, because so many websites for private investors, there's a lot of adverts, there's a lot of kind of interruption, and wanted to really create a different sort of environment that, gave a kind of an all-in-one solution, as it were, to bring the research, the data that you might need to invest successfully, and community in that sort of wonderful all-in-one sort of environment. And so we set out to do that, and that's been kind of running ever since. I mean, really, we started taking subscriptions in 2012. So we've now been 13 years like serving private investors and really developing our service through time and developing a lot of kind of rankings on shares, lots of tools and techniques for really outsmarting the market in a way, which really is quite a simple thing at the end of the day, but people overcomplicate it, chase stories and so on. And I mean, my own background, I had a bit of my portfolio suffered in that financial crisis quite badly. And I learned a lot of lessons coming out of that, how to sort of manage your own behavior and so on. And really kind of figured out that taking a more disciplined, repeatable, even systematic approach to the markets could really counter a lot of those emotional behaviors that kind of keep you hanging on shares, which might be tanking and things like that. And really, we've sort of built the whole service around trying to encourage or even nudge those sorts of behaviors. So it's been great for me, great for the subscriber base, really enjoy it. It's great fun. And here I am still doing it. So we've got a fabulous team and we're constantly developing the service, got lots of really good things lined up for the next year. So anyway, that's a little bit potted history.
Thank you very much. Fantastic. So you mentioned there a systematic approach, Ed, to UK stocks. And that's something that I'd like to start with, because, of course, you have a number of different tools within the Stockopedia platform available to investors. But one of your flagship offerings is your NAPS portfolio, which I believe stands for No Admin Portfolio System. And of course, that brings in a systematic approach to stocks. So it would be good if we could start the conversation with explaining what that is, how it works, and some of the, the underlying metrics that investors will gain from adopting that and following that and paying more attention to the approach that you take there.
Yeah, so I've been running this model portfolio now for almost 11 years, and it really began as a little bit, I sort of realized that we created this wonderful ranking system that maybe I'll talk about later, but we call it the Stock Ranks, and it measures in a very simple and easily understandable format where we rank all the shares from 0 to 100. It's like a scoring system where 100 is best across quality, value, and momentum. And this is kind of, that's a sort of a stock selection approach, which just helps you find high odds, high potential shares, because they tend to be good shares that are relatively undervalued, relatively strong momentum. And so that kind of can shift the odds in people's favor. And obviously we've got our platform gives a suite of research tools. And, you know, like I was saying, a sort of all-in-one solution. But then the other thing is a lot of people need help and coaching and illustration of how best to use those tools. So I wanted to show our audience a really good way to kind of objectively select shares, which didn't rely on, you know, discretion. And it was a way to sort of show the value of the, also the sort of the data. And so came up with this NAPS methodology, which, you know, many tip sheets and even the press, they do their tips of the year. And we've done quite a few data studies through time, which kind of show that share tips of the year often underperform. You know, there's that whole monkey with a dart kind of thing where, you know, they sort of slightly mock share tips in that a monkey with a dart can often outperform the tips from the press, the Macy's press, or even tip sheets. And we wanted to sort of do this in a different way, which showed that you could sort of systematically select shares on a completely objective basis and give yourself a better chance of outperforming. So it started with this sort of basis. And the idea was that and really this is kind of like, you know, the simplest way of describing it was picking the top two highest ranked shares from each of 10 sectors, the 10 sectors that we publish. So, you know, for example, energy and healthcare and technology and basic materials and all 10 of the sectors. And hold that in a 20 stock portfolio. And so these tend to be sort of 95, 99 ranks type shares. They're very high ranked. They're good, cheap, strong shares. And they're diversified across all the sectors. And it's a 20 stock portfolio. And then you just hold it equal weighted for a year. So in a way, it's a little bit like taking a sort of it's an active approach in that you're doing the stock picking and you're selecting the shares, but it's kind of passive because it's rules based. So it's very, very systematic and it's really easy to sort of put to work. And the idea behind it is that, you know, if you're consistently buying undervalued good quality shares, the market should do its work and it should reward those shares, because undervalued shares, you know, all the stock pickers will find them, bid them up a bit. Good shares, they tend to sort of, you know, reinvest their profits and do better. And then also, so we have this momentum angle, which is shares that are rising, especially if they're value shares, often keep rising and keep outperforming. So that was the kind of the thesis. And you know, I've been writing about this for, you know, a decade now. And it's been extraordinarily effective. And it's surprised even me, actually, how well it's done. So it's a great sort of validation. And I think it's done about, last I looked, was about 15% annualized with 2.5% dividends on top. But if you just look at that capital return, that's now become, I think, as of today, 345% return over the almost 11 years. So it's, and that's, you know, it's quite an outstanding performance when you compare it against what you might see with fund managers. We did a review on the 10 years and it had beaten every single fund manager in the UK in UK equities. It had also beaten the S&P 500. And that's, you know, it's quite remarkable when you think something which doesn't require you to have, you know, fly around and interview company executives, drive, you know, a Range Rover, you know, like all the fund managers do, who many are absolutely brilliant and very smart. It's not a dig at that. It's more that I kind of feel that human scale, you've got your own portfolio. Let's say somebody's investing a limited amount, you should be investing in the best opportunity set for the size of your portfolio. And the thing about the NAPS, even though there's often a lot of larger caps, mid caps, small caps, it can really, it can dive into sort of some of those smaller cap opportunities that fund managers can't really access because they've got too much capital. And maybe later we'll talk about some of the shares this year, but they're kind of illustrative of that kind of point. And so that's really driven the performance through time. And it's been a great year this year. It's up about 32%. Maybe I've covered some of the bases there of your question.
No, yeah, you have. Thank you very much for a really comprehensive answer there. And as you mentioned, we will discuss a little bit later on in the podcast some of the companies that are in there, some of the metrics that have found those companies in the first place and found their way into the portfolio. But I think Yeah, we're talking about the systematic approach. That, of course, is in response to a lot of issues that retail investors have. And I think that'll be quite a nice place to move on to now, Ed, in terms of, you know, why look at the NAPS portfolio? If you're a retail investor, why should you consider it? What are the issues that a lot of retail investors face from your perspective, yeah, if you're sitting there? And what's the solution there for you to some of these issues?
I mean, I sort of thinking about it for a very long time, and I have this sort of mental model of some of the phases that we go through as a stock picker. And, you know, many people start stock picking because, you know, they might be a bit fed up with average returns from fund managers, or they might be, maybe they hear a kind of an interesting idea or a thematic idea, and they go, God, there's a stock market thing and someone's doubled their money in some share and I should really be getting some of that. And I sort of see that people move through certain phases. There's kind of that first starting point. It's almost like a gambler, a sort of a gambler phase. And, you know, they might pick up an idea from social media or, you know, pub talk or whatever it might be, or you get a tip from somewhere and you don't do any due diligence, you just sort of pile in, got no idea of like position sizing or portfolio management. And you get really erratic outcomes. You might get lucky. In fact, getting lucky in your first share is probably the worst thing that can happen, because then you get even more overconfident. But, you know, you get have really emotional swings with that. And then, you know, people then kind of like, they start taking it a bit more seriously and they start hunting around for more authentic people to follow. So kind of move from the gambler phase to the follower phase. And that's about trying to find, you know, gurus. It might be a stockbroker. You might find you get access to broker research reports, or you follow someone on YouTube, or it might be a really great financial journalist. And there are many, many really, really good people who know exactly what they're talking about, who are writing and, you know, giving information. But still, from a personal basis, if you're following those people, you can still be chasing stories and you're trusting, you know, all these behavioral biases you talk about, like authority bias or, you know, social proof and so on, confirmation bias. You can sort of end up wrapped up in that. And people are very, very good. Like brokers, some vast majority of broker recommendations are buy recommendations. They're very, very rarely sell recommendations. And you find that across all financial media. Everyone is always like saying, oh, this is a good share. This one is a buy. And like I was saying, tips of the year, it's always buys. You don't ever get a sell list, do you, at the start of the year? Yeah. And so that also can lead to overconfidence, holding too long. You never kind of have that sell discipline. And I think once you've been burned a few times we're entirely doing that, you move into the next phase, which is like the researcher phase. And this is a really good phase. And many of the best investors I know are like really extraordinarily good at due diligence and doing research into individual shares. They sort of take that load on themselves of being, you know, the researcher rather than just following other people's ideas. And they build their spreadsheets, their models, and they kind of, you know, they read all the material they can on every share. But there's another problem with that is that you can end up getting more and more confident on shares the more information that you have. And there's this great study by a guy, I think he's called Paul Slovich, in 1973. And he basically kind of compared, he looked at horse tippers. So people that set the odds on horses and take people's bets. And he did this study and he asked them all, okay, what are the 40 pieces of information you need on a share? And he asked them you need on a horse to set the odds. And he asked them to rank them. And what he did is he gave all these different bookies basically the top five pieces of information that they needed to set the odds, and he asked them what their confidence was, and then he checked their accuracy, and then he gave them another kind of five pieces of information, another five pieces of information, all the way up to 40 pieces of information, and he checked their confidence and accuracy at each point. And what happened was that the more information that these bookies got, the more confident they got in the odds they were setting, but their accuracy didn't get any better. And I think this is a really interesting analogy to stock picking, because if you're researching shares, you will, you know, as you own a share, you get more and more and more and more information, and all you do is become more overconfident. And it's so easy to ride shares up, become more and more confident. And I see it time and time again, the biggest winners in the market can end up sort of plummeting, people hold too long. So even when you become a researcher, you going from gambler to follower to researcher, you can even have that the same suffer from biases and so on. So I guess like the journey kind of another level I kind of sort of perceive, which is like more of a craftsman. And once you kind of really understand the way that the market rewards your investments. So if I go back to quality, value, and momentum, the value effect is about buying undervalued shares, but you only earn that value premium when those shares rise if you sell. You know, buying and holding most value stocks forever is actually, especially in British markets, not really necessarily the wise thing to do, because so often you see them kind of revert to the mean. So you need to have an approach, a sort of that craft of actually making sure that you've got a discipline to have a sell discipline on it. There are the occasional shares like the Games Workshops, which is like very high quality company, which can reinvest its own capital and compound through time. And everybody wants to own those shares, the ones that just go up. But, you know, they are quite rare, and they're actually in a portfolio of like 10, 20 shares. It's quite rare that you find like can pack a portfolio full of them. Even that's what everybody wants to do. Most shares go up, go down, and so on. So there's sort of this craft of like balancing, finding great shares, finding, especially in value investing, finding undervalued shares, but having that exit discipline, you know, not getting too attached, not too confident. And I think like, so something like the sort of more, you know, systematic approach or having a consistent, repeatable process. The best investors have that exit plan for most of their investments. You know, I think it was David Drehman, who was a great value investor in America, wrote lots of books about it. And he just said, look, whenever they buy low PE shares and they will sell them when they get to average or above average PE. And they just have that discipline. And anyway, so these things, the craft of investing is quite subtle like that, but it's really quite easy as well in a way. It's simple. I wouldn't say it's easy because, you know, we all get attached to our shares, but there are simple effects that are very repeated in the market, but it's not that easy to implement. You've got to be very unbiased. You've got to be very kind of rigorous and disciplined and consistent in your actions. And I think that's certainly the NAPS has a very simple solution to that. But, you know, there are lots of other ways too. So, I mean, that's kind of like, for me, I've thought about this a lot because, you know, I had those issues in the financial crisis and I got over attached and I really was looking for repeatable process that I could rely on to reliably sort of generate and retain good investment returns, and not have that sort of boom bust kind of thing that happens in so many portfolios. So I know that's a bit of a long-winded answer to your question, but I hope that makes sense.
It does indeed. I mean, I think the underlying points there, Ed, is, you know, don't get married to the trade. You know, when I started off in the industry, that's one of the things I teach you. Don't get married to the trade. And that is difficult, as you said. You know, if you spent a lot of time researching a stock, you like what you see, it starts going up, and you get some nice returns. It is very difficult.
But it's also challenging because there's something called the disposition effect, which is that, you know, we've all heard that maxim, you know, run your winners, cut your losers. And that is a fantastic maxim that everyone should stick to. The truth is, if you look at the actual behavior of how most people behave, they sell their winners, they snatch at profits, and they hold their losers. And people hold their losers because they think they're right and they want them to get back to even. Nobody thinks they've taken a loss until they've sold. So they want the loser to come back to even, but then the losers just very often just keep going down. You can end up with a value trap or something like that. So training yourself to have exit discipline without snatching at early profits is really hard. You need to give enough time for the winners to run. And that's why I really lean on rules and rules-based discipline in your investing, because otherwise, if you don't have rules, there's something that this great educator, Van Tharp, once said. He said, if you don't have rules, everything you do is a mistake. So, you know, if you make lots of money in a trade, if you haven't had any rules around it, you know, it's a mistake because it's not a repeatable process. And that's really key.
So we're going to move on now, Ed, and look at some of those rules that you've discussed there to help remove some of those biases in investing. I think a good place to start would be the stock ranks, because that's fundamental to Stockopedia's approach. We did discuss it very briefly at the beginning. So if you could elaborate on the stock ranks. And I think what would be really interesting for investors is to sort of break down the metrics that sit behind that stock rank as well, so they can get a really good idea of what they're looking at when they're looking at a stock.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the problems we're trying to solve by creating the stock ranks is that if you come to the stock market, it seems like it's full of jargon, right? You're going to see valuation ratios. And okay, everybody sort of knows the PE ratio and the dividend yield. And, you know, but there's already a little hump to understanding that. Like, what is a PE of 12 really? You know, is that average? Is that a below average, above average? What about a PE of 25? What about a, you know, you don't really have any boundaries on some of these. Or you might see Palantir on a PE of 200. Like, how are you meant to turn that into an effective, like, investment rule? But then beyond that, you've got complicated measures. It might be going, you know, further from price to sales, EV to EBITDA, price to tangible book. And suddenly you're in this kind of world of like jargon that most lay investors are kind of, it's almost like this wall you've got to get through of like education. And really the core concepts are so simple beneath them. If you look at things like, you know, quality metrics like return on capital employed, or, you know, the gearing ratios, or, you know, or more esoteric things like Altman Z scores and things, you just like, it takes a lifetime to kind of learn what all these things are. And for me, you know, the whole point of like innovating the stock ranks was to make it simple. Everybody can understand the idea of going and, you know, you go to a market, you're trying to find buy quality produce at a reasonable price, right? Quality at a reasonable price. And also everybody understands fashion, which is like, you know, you know when things are moving into, you know, popularity, that trend can really persist sort of for a whole season. So we sort of understand these things conceptually. And the idea of the stock ranks is to take a lot of these more complex financial metrics, but be able to bundle them into a very easily understandable number or measure. And essentially what that means is that, so if we take the quality rank, we really look at three dimensions. We look to see if it's a good profitable company. So that might have very high profitability metrics. It might have good margins. It might be stable and that kind of thing. And we also look if it's got improving fundamentals, so that the financial ratios are getting better from 1 year to the next. And we also look to see whether it's safe. So we'll look at bankruptcy risk and earnings risk. And we bundle all that into a very simple percentile score. I won't talk about all the kind of details behind it, but it ranks everything from zero worst. So those would be the really junk, unprofitable, capital consuming companies, very blue sky companies. And 100 would be best. So I would assume something like Games Workshop's got a quality rank of 99 or something like that. And that really sort of illustrates, you know, it makes it so easy for somebody to understand. You know, if you see a 90 plus quality ranked share, you know, it's in the top 10% best quality businesses on the market. And then take the same principle to value, where we take lots of valuation metrics across comparing the value of the company or the price of the company against its, you know, its earnings, against its sales, its assets, and so on. And we use the same sort of idea where 100 is cheapest and zero is most expensive. So Games Workshop is very premium. So I presume that I don't have the numbers in front of me, but Games, well, actually, I can probably bring them up. But Games Workshop would be a premium share. So it's got a, actually, it's got a 100 quality rank. It's got a 12 value rank. So it's very expensive. It's on a high P ratio, and the other valuation ratios are very high. And then the third dimension is momentum. And this is sort of the more counterintuitive one, because everybody likes trying to buy things when they're, because you're trying to buy things that are cheap, which are kind of good value. Often people take the wrong idea of that, and they go and find shares that are beaten down. They try and buy shares which are at real lows. And the truth about momentum, it's the most powerful force, is that shares that are reaching new lows a year later tend to be at even lower lows. Funnily enough, shares that are actually going to new highs tend to go to higher highs. While most people try and buy low, sell high, actually you want to try and buy high, sell higher. And that works especially well with value stocks. So if you've got value stocks that are cheap, that are maybe have been beaten down over 5 years, but suddenly they're doing well over the last 6 or 12 months, they're still undervalued, but their price momentum is really driving the right direction. And that really is one of the foundations of the momentum score. So you have these three quality rank, value rank, momentum rank. And then we bring them all together in an equal weighted thing we call the stock rank, which is QVM, quality, value, momentum, and it's sort of one overall score. So this is really the kind of the foundation. It gives a very simple way for people to understand stock analysis, and it's also tremendously effective. I mean, you know, if you see a 99 ranked share, there's no guarantee it's going to be a winner. You know, I think our statistics are that in the average year, and some years the stock market goes down and all shares go down if it's in a bear market, but in the average year since we launched them in 2013, There's been 62% winners in the high rank share cohorts, whereas if you look at the low rank cohorts, there's only been 25% winners. So low rank shares, which tend to be your kind of blue sky, jam tomorrow shares, they just have such odds against you. And that's really the kind of the core idea, is that you want to load your portfolio with higher ranked shares because you've got a tailwind behind your investments. You're going to really benefit from, you know, value effect, like driving them forwards and, you know, find better quality shares and so on. But when people sort of first bring their portfolios onto Stockopedia, they're kind of surprised because they have see all of these kind of low ranked shares and they're like, well, and suddenly they have this sort of like reality check going, oh, well, no wonder maybe I've been underperforming. So that's kind of that's the core principle. And you see this sort of change in people's investing, and they will then start weeding out the kind of, you know, the red low ranked shares and start replacing with higher ranked shares. And, you know, not always, but like, you know, generally people's performance will get more consistent if they're doing that kind of thing. So it's just a kind of very, you know, solid and robust stock selection system. It's only really one part of an overall investment approach. It's that stock selection, picking higher ranked shares, is one part of a process, really.
So let's look at the practicalities of this now, Ed, and look at this at work over the last year. Because I think you outlined at the beginning a 32% return for the portfolio so far this year. We have had a surprisingly good year for UK equities, especially the FTSE 100 benchmark. But of course, that 32% does outstrip that in terms of performance. So let's get stuck into it. Let's drill down into it. What were the key stocks within the portfolio that drove that performance this year?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because I was at a conference recently and, you know, lots and lots of good stock pickers, but there's been very divergent results. Like some of the best stock pickers I know have actually had kind of flattish years. And if you look at the AIM market as a whole, it's pretty much flat to up. Whereas the FTSE 100, last time I looked, it was up so 17-18%. But that's been very loaded with defense shares, banks, and so on, and some of the resources stocks. So it's been very focused in certain sectors. But in terms of the NAPS portfolio, the interesting thing is there's no defense shares at all in it. But what's driven the performance? I think two of the absolute standouts were that there were two gold shares, two gold juniors. One is Serabi Gold, which has Brazilian gold operations, and the other one is Metals Exploration. And they're both up about 150% each year to date. And so that, you know, we've seen that in, you know, FTSE 100 shares, you know, you've got Fresnillo and Hochschild Mining and stuff, that these large cap, all the gold shares have done rather well. And if somebody didn't own the gold sector at all this year, they've missed out on really astounding returns. Now, that wasn't necessary. I mean, it was sort of predictable that it would have a good year, but this sort of outstanding year has really been driven by the gold price. And I think this kind of goes to why I always say that I sort of encourage sector diversity. I was talking about portfolio construction earlier, and the NAPS method takes two stocks from every from all the 10 sectors. And if you are a sort of investor who's more bottom up, you might find that you only actually have industrials or consumer stocks, and many portfolios are very, very loaded in just a few sectors. And of course, if they haven't really gone anywhere in the year, you know, you've really missed out on some of those corners of the market, which can really drive returns over the long term. In terms of actual names, the Serabi Gold, Metals Exploration, the portfolio did well. It had Alliance Pharma, which got a bid at the start of the year. So that was a 40% on that share. There's been a few financials like, but you know, unusual ones like International Personal Finance, IPF, that's also had a bid offer. It's not closed yet. That's up about 67%. Journeo is a lovely little small cap company that does a lot of kind of displays in train stations. And they do sort of bus tech as well. And they're kind of benefiting from that sort of green spending, and they've diversified into a kind of a security business as well. So that's been a really big winner this year. Even Vodafone, surprisingly. So the portfolio approach, it will even pick, you know, in sectors like telecoms, where there's only not very many shares. And Vodafone is kind of share you just never expect to do well, but it was cheap. It was good quality at the start of the year, or questionable quality maybe, but it's up about 41%. And this approach picks those sorts of surprising shares. Currys is another one. You know, Currys, where you kind of think, well, is that getting disrupted by the internet? But no, that's been another 35% return year to date. And at the start of the year, nobody wanted to touch shares like Kingfisher or Currys, which both had very strong years, because they were exposed to, you know, all the national insurance hikes, and everyone was very bearish on any retail. But actually, again, that shows how value investing works. You know, you're often picking up shares in out of favor sectors. So that's kind of like a bit of a spread. I think the portfolio had 75% winners, so 15 winners out of 20 this year. There was a, you know, one of the shares was bought out, Ocean Wilson's, at a bit of a loss. But it's been really, really quite a good year. So, but there have been some losers. Hikma Pharma was down 25%. U Group, which was a big winner for me personally over a number of years, that's down 19% this year. So, you know, it's in a portfolio approach, you're always going to have some losers, some winners. I think it's had the approach has had about a 58% of picking winners over the 10 or 11 years. And so that's on average year to year. So it's got this kind of small edge, small repeatable edge. And that's really what you kind of end up relying on. But the winners win also a lot more than the losers lose. So you get that kind of compounding effect through time.
You mentioned there a company was taken over. That's just something I'd like to pick up on quickly. And I don't know whether you have any information on this in front of you, because it's quite a specific question. But, you know, just any background would be great. You know, of course, one of the issues with the UK market is generally it's undervalued. Yeah. And we're seeing quite a lot of takeovers coming in because, of course, you know, the so-called smart money of private equity are taking a lot of these companies private, or indeed, you know, that their competitors, you know, maybe overseas competitors, are seeing a lot of valuation and a lot of value in the share price there, and then taking them over. It would be good to get some sort of comparison in terms of how many companies within the NAPS portfolio have been taken over, because that would be a really good gauge to, you know, pit, you know, the smart money and their thinking there against, you know, some of the metrics that you're using within the NAPS portfolio.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you have any data on that, but it'd be really interesting to get your thoughts on
that. Well, I mean, I think about it. I mean, it's surprising. There's definitely been more this year. And I mean, I've got a kind of, I was looking at this recently, and in our screenable UK universe, I think 2 years ago, there were 1,550 shares in our screener. And I think at the current count, and this kind of generally excludes investment trusts and things, I think at the moment, there are, how do we see, there's 1,239. So I think we're probably about 250, 300 shares down after like the last 2 or 3 years in terms of the number of shares in the market. So that's really shows how many have delisted or been taken over. And in the NAPS this year, there's been 3 corporate actions, and this is definitely the highest there's ever been. And I've, you know, there have been a few bids here and there, but never normally more than like one a year in the portfolio. This year, you saw there was Alliance Pharma, which was bought out in the bid came in January, and I think it's sort of by May it had kind of been delisted. There is also, as I said, a current bid on International Personal Finance, which is still trading, still listed, but it's under offer. And then the other corporate action was Ocean Wilson's, which has essentially merged with an investment trust. So it's, you know, that sort of gives a bit of an indication. I think one of the things about the NAPS, it does kind of, because it's often looking for high quality undervalued companies. Those are often cash generative businesses that often can be takeover targets. And there's kind of can be a little bit of a skew towards smaller companies, smaller and mid-cap companies, which is sort of are in that zone for predators, as it were. But, you know, I think we're going to see, I think we will see a shift in coming years, because private equity is, I don't know a good way to say it, but private equity is sort of a bit constipated. It needs a public market to exit to. And the public markets have not, because there's been a lot of fund outflows, the public markets are not, they don't really have enough capital at the moment. So the government are going to have to, they're going to shake up the pension system and so on. And I think we will see a bit of a wave of new listings in coming years. But it was a pretty bad year for IPOs this year. So, you know, at some point, something's got to shift. But I don't think it's all bad, you know, because like you get a bid on a company, it gives you a quick pop, gives you a nice return. People often moan about it because it takes good companies that you want to invest in for the long term out of the market. But then again, you know, you find that what's happening is that the fund managers receive the money and they're delighted because they're currently seeing fund outflows from UK funds. And that means they don't have to sell their other shares. They get cash for the bid targets, which then they can use for redemptions. And if they have any left over, they kind of put it back into their other holdings. So there's a kind of a, there's a sort of a bid under the UK market. It's undervalued. you know, smart money are buyers, and fund managers have got a little bit of excess cash to put in every now and then when they do get those bids coming in. So yeah, and it's interesting times, but I don't. It's quite a good environment for value investors because, you know, UK is so neglected, but it's undervalued. And like that is really kind of a wonderful environment for a value investor because you can just go and get cherry pickings everywhere, really.
Yes, I mean, a lot of the fund managers that we speak to, especially the value ones focused on UK equities, have had a tremendous year. I mean, they've had a tough time of it over the last decade with momentum stocks, growth stocks, especially in the US, capturing all of the attention. But certainly, we've really seen that value play come to the fore. This year, so that's been a really good place to be. So Ed, of course we've spoken about what happened last year, but I'm sure listeners to this would be interested to hear about what's to come, what happens in 2026, how can they get involved in the NAPS portfolio, what's the process for it, you know, is it a guide that you publish, is it something you have to sign up for? You know, a little bit of background on what to expect, you know, whether you've got any early inklings on what's going to be in there and how can people get involved with
that? I think the first thing to say is like we're not financial advisors, we really educate, you know, we provide all the tools, provide all the rankings, we provide the environment for DIY investors. And I've always sort of said that the NAPS process is like I make the analogy, it's like a jazz sheet to riff off rather than a score to recite. You know, there are some people I know who just kind of copy the portfolio, and like I run some family money very, very similarly to the actual annual portfolio I publish. But it really is like the rules are very adaptable. So I know a lot of people take the rules and they apply it internationally. You know, I know people who've, because the NAPS at the moment is a UK portfolio. And obviously it's just a published portfolio. So it's not, we don't run money based on it. But people use it and apply it in their own DIY investing. And they might sort of then choose European shares or American shares or Australian shares. And they also might adapt the rules for their own flavor. So they might like say, oh, I don't want to have any in this sector, or I want to have more in this sector. And they might change their sell rules and the rankings that they use. Some people use it as a basis for dividend investing. So they'll put a higher yield barrier on it to get higher dividend yield shares. So it's kind of like I advocate and educate around the process and encourage people to sort of like think about it and make it match whatever their own objectives are. But what we do, so basically on January the 1st, I always publish like a big piece, which actually shows the latest portfolio. And then we give updates through the year. And I'm also doing so that will be on the site for subscribers January the 1st. So if anyone's interested, you can obviously, people can take a trial and, you know, with no commitment and sort of see what's going on there. But we'll also be doing I'll be doing a much deeper dive webinar on it. I think the date's to be set, but we'll share it for your show notes. And so that's that. I'm hoping we could also publish a bit more of a robust guide on it. But we always do webinars and editorial on the site around this. So that's kind of the way that you could best, you know, come in and find this. And the other great thing is going on the site. If you own shares, you can go and check all the ranks of your own shares and see how that all fits together. So lots to do there.
Perfect. Yeah, really good point there, Ed. We will put in the notes to this podcast a link through to that webinar when you have it. So anybody listening to this that would like to know a little bit more, do get yourself signed up for that. That will be in the new year. So really, really comprehensive conversation today, Ed. I think it would be really good if we could wrap things up now. And you know, you're a real champion for retail investing. It would be good if we could finish with a key message that you'll give to retail stock pickers on what they should be doing, what they should be thinking about, and what some of the key themes you see are for 2026.
Well, I'm not one for forecasts, and I know the brokerage community will come out and go, the market's going to do this year, and they all put their number on it. And I always think that's a fool's game. I mean, the evidence on forecasting is pretty comprehensive that it doesn't really work. What I do know is that, as I said, I always try and apply simple rules. And I do that for stock picking as well as for understanding if the market's in an okay state or not. And I think if the market's in an okay state, often you'll see that there can be relatively okay returns for shares. If you have you can get lucky, have a good year like I've had this year. And in my own personal portfolio, I've had a great year. But it's, you know, next year, there's something I took from long ago, which is a maxim from a guy called Martin Zweig, who predicted the 87 stock market crash. And he had this, he wrote a fantastic book. And I remember one of his phrases, which was, and he's American, so he's using American language, don't fight the tape, don't fight the Fed. Or it might've been the other way around. Don't fight the Fed, don't fight the tape. What that means is, you know, the Fed set interest rates in America. When interest rates are going up, don't fight it. When they're coming down, don't fight it. Generally, when interest rates are coming down, that's positive for equities. And if they're going up, it's often negative for equities. And, you know, you often see more bearish environments. And rates are coming down at the moment. You know, I think Bank of England are probably going to cut rates. And we've been on this downward progression over the last sort of year or two. And that's been helpful for, you know, share valuations. The other thing is don't fight the tape. And this is really about the fact that when the markets are going up, they have a tendency to go up the next year as well. So I always look at it like that. And the third act maxim I really have is like, well, if a market's undervalued and it's going up and rates coming down, that's often an okay environment for equity investing. So I sort of see it like that. I see that I'm very happy to be a fully invested equity investor right now, in spite of all the big worries. Yes, we've got all kinds of fears about, you know, overinvestment in AI and the Mag 7 being such a dominant part of the S&P 500. And there is no doubt that if, you know, people, those worries become self-fulfilling and the market in America, the S&P 500 has a significant correction, it's probably going to affect other markets. Will definitely, because they're very correlated, the UK market might come down a bit. But the thing is, within the market, there's always revaluation of undervalued shares. The people are always trying to find those shares, fund managers, private investors. And so even in kind of like, you know, I think the worst year ever for the NAPS was, I think, negative 15%. Although actually in the pandemic, I think the worst drawdown in the middle of a year was 40% in that crash in the pandemic. So, you know, that you can never predict what's going to happen, you know, but I'm comfortable being fully invested at the moment. And so that would be really, really my read. And, you know, in terms of sector themes, again, I'm not really kind of wild about doing predictions. There are certain sectors that, you know, the valuations have got very, very punchy and very stretched. And me, I've got a value investing bias. So I'm no longer an investor in kind of defense exposed sectors, because I think a lot of the easy gains have been made. But that is a big, big macro trade. And I know a lot of people are looking at those sort of sectors and going, well, there's so much growth to come. But I've got my rules. I've got my way of approaching the market. And it's proven very effective over the long term. So I don't see any reason to change it.
Really interesting point you made there about the defense stocks. Actually, they've had a pretty soft period. Seem to go a little bit ahead of themselves. That seems to be quite a good call that you've made there, yeah. Ed. So just as a final note to listeners, please do check out the notes to this podcast, because there will be a link through to the webinar that will be held in early 2026. We'll be able to delve a little bit deeper into the stock ranks, the NAPS portfolio, and some of the selections that Ed has spoken about today. So Ed, thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Great. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a good chat.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.